So I want to speak today about different questions, both in the theoretical general sense as well as a number of case studies, actual examples of the interplay between secular law and halacha. There are actually Chash Mishpat in particular, Chash Mishpat and Ebenezer. Chash Mishpat and Ebenezer together essentially are what we would consider civil law and family law. Arachayim and Yaradeya basically in halacha is basically the ritual. Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras Mishpacha, stuff like that. Chash Mishpat is basically civil law. It technically includes criminal law too, but as I said, we don't really do much in the way of criminal law in contemporary Western societies. So Chash Mishpat, civil law and halacha, basically, as it is today, as it always was, but especially as it is today, essentially is the interplay of three factors. There is the halacha itself, the stuff you learn in the Torah, Pashas Mishpatim, the stuff in the Gemaras, Bava Kama, Bava Basra particularly, and the family stuff in Ksuvas and Gittin, Kedushin. So that's the first vertex of the triangle. You're dealing with the raw halacha itself, the stuff that you learn, you know, that's been being developed for several millennia already. The second thing that always has to be considered is custom, the prevailing custom. The Gemara already talks about this in many cases. Custom, of course, plays a role in all areas of halacha. On Hilcha Shabbos, we have all kinds of minhagim, but especially in Chosh and Mishpat, custom plays a very important role. Because halacha itself, the raw halacha itself, as I understand it, tends to be fairly laissez-faire. While there are certain restrictions on what you can do, halacha is pretty much a kind of 19th century capitalistic society. I mean, freedom of contract, as long as things are specified, you can pretty much specify whatever you want. There is very little, you know, the state plays some role, but a fairly small one. You have to give tzedakah, and the state will prevent certain kinds of abuses, but not all that much. And a lot of it boils down to contracts. Whatever you specify, contracts, but by contract I mean both an explicit contract, a document drawn up by a lawyer, as well as implicit contracts, verbal contracts, verbally explicit ones, implicit ones. And that's where custom fits in, because one of the most common applications of custom, anytime you're dealing with an arrangement where there has not been a precise specification of what both parties are expected to do, then custom will fill in the blanks. So, for example, I hire a bricklayer. In Chazal's examples, I hire a bricklayer. I tell him to work, but I don't say exactly what time he should show up in the morning. So it says, Makom Shenagu, to come at sunrise. You come at sunrise, the place where the custom was to come later. You come later, Hakol Kamin and Kamadina. Rambam especially tends to constantly qualify halachas by saying, and everything depends on the custom. So where custom applies in halacha depends very much on what kind of issue we're talking about. On the one hand, we have issues which are essentially contractual, as I said before, such as landlord-tenant relations, such as employer-employee relations. These are areas where, again, halacha is laissez-faire. Halacha allows you to specify pretty much whatever terms you want. So if you take the trouble and have the foresight to specify exactly what you want, then that will control. If you do not, then custom will often fill in the blanks. The mechanics of this is simply that the prevailing custom is as though you spoke it out, unless you spoke out something to the contrary. As though it was stipulated, the custom is a kind of implicit contract. And that's basically the area in which custom is strongest. On the other hand, you have halachas which are completely unrelated to any contractual issues, such as inheritance law. The Torah tells us in detail, both Torah Shmosav and then the Gemaras, tell us, the Seder of Yerusha, tell us who inherits, who inherits first, if that person is not around, who inherits, who's next in line. And Yerusha is probably the single area where the poskim have been most vehemently opposed to following anything except the raw halacha, any custom, any law, because the Torah tells us what to do, and we're supposed to follow the Torah. Now, again, foresight is always critical, because if you do realize that the Torah's Yerusha sequence is not the one that you desire, there are ways around it. You can write different kinds of wills, you can write different kinds of documents, either bequests or gifts, or actual wills. Exactly how to do that and satisfy the requirements of halacha is a very complicated topic, and we're not going to get into that, but the point is it can be circumvented. However, in the absence of any will or any proper bequest, halacha will control, and most poskim say that we will not care particularly about the custom or about the law. There are some minority opinions that we do, but the mainstream opinion is that we do not. In between Yerusha on the one hand and purely contractual things like landlord-tenant relations on the other hand, you deal is things like torts, nizikin. So halacha does have a fairly robust, fairly comprehensive body of law discussing, we get dinei Torah about fender benders all the time, slip and fall, stuff like that. Halacha does have a fairly well-developed set of rules. These are not new situations. I mean, cars are different from horses, obviously, but the underlying principles are quite similar. However, here, many poskim do say that we follow minhag, even though it's not really a contractual arrangement. Even though the injured party and the aggressor have had no prior relationship and certainly have no contract, implicit or explicit, many poskim will feel that we follow the custom. Many poskim will allow you to sue in secular court and file a claim against to collect money from the aggressor's insurance. This is minhag. Minhag is not our primary theme, but I mention it because what is it? What is our main topic? Dinat Malchusa, the law of the land, is inextricably intertwined with minhag. When we discuss the question of whether halacha recognizes what the law says in a specific case, there are several different mechanisms by which we have to approach the question. One very important one is minhag. As we have said, in many cases, halacha defers to the custom, certainly contractual cases, and even, as we've said, cases which are not really contractual, halacha does follow the prevailing custom. So many poskim have argued, especially in the last 150 years, that the law of the land creates a de facto prevailing custom. Unless you're in a situation where the law is flouted and generally ignored, the law generally will serve as a baseline to generate a custom. And custom is generally binding in many areas of Chosh Mishpat. So, for example, rent control legislation, which we're going to discuss in a little more depth later if we have time, but rent control legislation, Moshe Feinstein has a very famous response where he says that he doesn't want to discuss the other aspects of the law. He says, however, the law will create a custom. People generally will follow such laws. And as long as the law had already been on the books at the time the tenant moved in, then there is an automatic presumption that their relationship is going to be governed by the custom, which in turn is determined by the law. So Rav Moshe said that rent control legislation would be honored by halacha because it would create a custom. And Rav Moshe is not actually the first one to say this. This has been proposed in the 19th century already. But this is essentially the three influences. These are the three influences that we deal with in halacha: the raw halacha itself, the custom, and the law, the halacha, the secular law, and custom. Halacha itself will generally override. If halacha explicitly says, according to the poskim, that this is a case where we don't care about the custom, we don't care about the law, halacha will override for a religious Jew. However, halacha does accept the validity of the law and the custom in many cases. And as we said, the law in turn influences the custom, and custom may influence whether we care about a law. If the custom is that a law is ignored, that may have some significance in halacha too. So with this basic introduction, we can discuss a few specific examples, some of which will fit into this pattern, some of which will maybe not fit into this pattern so well. So the first source I mentioned here, Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson on intellectual property, is really one of the most remarkable halachic arguments that I have ever seen, especially in Chosh Mishpat. Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson was a great, prolific, late 19th century authority. He wrote thousands of responsa. He wrote many works. And basically, any sefer with the name Shaul and Yosef in it is probably his. He authored dozens and dozens of svarim. So he was asked the question about intellectual property. Intellectual property in the modern sense includes essentially patents for inventions or software patents, which are controversial in the open source world, but patents, usually typically for medicine or machinery, and today for things like software, algorithms. Copyright, which protect music, literature, and trademarks, trademarks which are the signs or symbols by which companies are known. The equivalent body of halacha is primarily deals with mostly copyright, what we would call copyright, and to a lesser extent, trademarks. So there isn't much literature on this before about 150 years ago, partly because certainly in the last several decades we have, with the digital revolution, the ease and the low cost and the simplicity with which we can make copies obviously changes the landscape dramatically. But even before that, for whatever reason, there was very little halachic discussion on intellectual property before about a century or two ago. Almost no Talmudic discussion. I mean, there is no Talmudic discussion. There are some Talmudic passages which some poskim have tried to argue have some indirect bearing on the issue. But basically, it is an extremely frustrating area of halacha because it has to be kind of retrofitted onto the Gemara without your normal, well-established train of inferences from clear Talmudic precedents to Rishonim, to Achronim, Shulchan Aruch, poskim, contemporary poskim. So one of the most remarkable and a fairly early source on intellectual property is a response from Rabbi Yosef Shalom Nathanson. He was asked about what we would consider essentially a copyright case. It had to do with the republication of a sefer, and there was a dispute. I think it was between the heirs of the original author or the publisher. I forget exactly who the parties to the dispute were, but basically the underlying question was: should the author or his heirs or people who had succeeded to his rights, should they have any authority to prevent others from copying the work? And as I've said, there's really virtually no direct, clear precedent in the earlier halacha on this topic. So Rabbi Yosef Shalom Nathanson basically just cut the Gordian knot and created one out of whole cloth. He said, this is what everyone does, this is what the Gentiles do, this is what general society does. There is a generally recognized, basically we would call a minhag, a right to intellectual property, a right to protect to protect the rights of the author and to obtain compensation for the use of one's creative work. And he quotes actually an interesting anecdote. I don't know the people involved, but he says that there was a fellow named Avram Yaakov of Horovshov, some European Jew, who had Asa HaChezbon B'Mashin, called Yom, Asa HaChezbon B'Mashin. Basically, he invented some kind of early adding machine. I checked the Wikipedia pages for the history of calculators and adding machines. There were all kinds of them invented in the mid-19th century. I have no idea what his machine was, how innovative it was, how useful it was, but whatever it was, he said this Jew had developed this kind of early calculator. And Kol Yomov Kibel Skaro Me'akira B'Varsha. All his days he had received, basically what we would call royalties, he had received payments for the use of his invention from the government in Warsaw, the Polish government apparently. So Rabbi Yosef Shaul cites that as a precedent. He says if the Polish government or whoever controlled Poland at that time was paying royalties for an adding machine, lo yehei tara shlema shalanu kisicha b'teila shalahem. That's the line from which I drew the title of this. He says our tara should not be behindhand, should not be worse than general law. If general law and general custom recognizes that an inventor is entitled to profit from his invention, we ought to recognize the same thing. So without any real precedent, without any close, careful Talmudic argument, he just says, custom recognizes it, local law recognizes it, it's a common sense idea, ergo we recognize it too. So this is not quite the majority opinion in the poskim. Most poskim have struggled after him to try to find other justifications for intellectual property, try to fit it into numerous other, shoehorn it into numerous other halakhic categories. Some poskim have made arguments based on Din Malchusa. Din Malchusa, you know, the direct application to the law of the land is an extremely complicated topic and beyond the scope of this talk. But basically, I'm not saying we necessarily rule in accordance with this view. I'm just pointing out that this is one remarkably bold, remarkably straightforward approach to modern law. We simply import it wholesale into the halacha by arguing that if halacha has nothing to say about a topic, it should recognize what are common sense and commonly accepted notions of fairness and legality. So that's Rabbi Yosef Shalom Nathanson. The second source I have here, this is actually Hilchos Shabbos, nothing to do with Choshen Mishpat. This is more a philosophical question. This would not have that direct application to Choshen Mishpat, but this is just what I find fascinating, what I at least find fascinating, a very sharp dispute among the poskim, but how to deal with the fundamental moral concepts or fundamental, you know, legal concepts of non-Jews. We know that on Shabbos you're not allowed to ask, generally one is not permitted to ask a non-Jew to do prohibited work for one's benefit. This is the general rule, that you cannot simply go over to a non-Jew and say, light this fire for me. There are, of course, many exceptions, you know, for illness, for many other cases, and again, this is not, the details are complicated, but in general, one may not ask a non-Jew to do work for a Jew on Shabbos. There are, as we said, certain exceptions. One of the primary exceptions is something we call kablanus. Kablanus roughly translates into the legal notion of contracting. That if the non-Jew is not told, do this at this time, he's simply told, I have a job for you, get this back to me in a week, and he chooses to do the work on Shabbos, that's okay. So if I, for example, if I go to a cleaner's and I say, clean these clothes, and he says, I'll have them ready for you in a week, that would be a classic example. Even if he chooses to do it on Shabbos, you don't need to specify, don't do it on Shabbos, because that's his business. How he wants to do it is his affair. Again, the rules are complicated, but that is the general idea. So based on these principles, one of the common questions discussed in the post-game was construction. If one is hiring a non-Jewish firm, non-Jewish laborers, to do construction work on Jewish property, so if you're paying them on an hourly wage, they're punching a clock, that's a problem. If they're doing what we call kaplanas, you simply tell them, I need this building up in 6 months, and I don't care when you do it, just make sure it gets done. That would be called kaplanas. And as I recall, there are many poskim, it's not unanimous, but there are many poskim that say that is okay. So along came the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham, one of the important Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch, printed on the standard page, he said that some poskim, Hayanir Lahatir, Livnos Beis HaKnesses, B'Shabbos, B'Kablanos, at least the synagogue, he allowed, according to certain opinions, with certain conditions, he would have allowed to build it through the work of non-Jews, through a contracting arrangement. However, he adds a caveat, he adds a restriction. Mikol Makom Re'isi Shegedolim L'Rotzu La'Tiro, I have seen that the great ones were not willing to permit it, even though halakhically it should be fine. Ki bizman hazeh, ein hagoyim menichin l'shum adam l'asas melachas farhesya b'yom chagam. The non-Jews will not allow any work done for them on the days of their holidays. The language is fairly cryptic, but he seems to have meant that the Christians, the European 18th century or so, Christians were fairly religious, at least publicly, and at least in these matters, they would not allow work to be done for them on Sunday, even if the workers were not Christians. Even if a Jew was working for a Christian, the Christians would say, you may not work on Shabbos, you must stop. And they felt that was a violation of their religious strictures against Sunday work. So, im naniach anachnu lasos ikachil Hashem. If we will allow non-Jews to work for us, the Christians will, so to speak, be firmer than us. They'll say, well, we know how to keep our holidays, you don't. That's a problem. So the Magen Avraham said, therefore, in places where this was the Christian custom, we should not do this either. This Magen Avraham and how to understand it was the subject of it actually played a small part, but it played a small role in one of the most bitter, one of the fiercest halachic controversies in the 20th century. The actual question is fairly technical. It involves certain fertility procedures, and as we know, in these kinds of issues, the Christians, the Catholics in particular, are very, very squeamish. They tend to be much stricter than we are on things like abortion, cloning, these types of topics. So this particular issue had aroused a great deal of controversy within the Jewish community. And Moshe Feinstein, probably the greatest American posek of the 20th century, was willing to be lenient. In certain cases, where the woman was desperate to have a child, he was willing to be lenient. And he was fiercely opposed by many, many other poskim. Now, we can say all we want, that halacha is supposed to be pure, objective, neutral, legalistic reasoning, but Ashkafa seems to have played a role here. Many of his opponents were Hasidim, they were people who had, on tznius issues, tended to have a much stricter, much narrower view. One of his fiercest opponents was Rav Yaakov Breisch, a posek from Switzerland, a great posek from Switzerland, with, I think, some Hasidic inclinations. He was absolutely furious with Rav Moshe. So their correspondence went back and forth, and they made numerous technical arguments. But for our purpose, one of the most interesting arguments was that Rav Breisch adduced the fact that Catholics consider this repellent. As I quote here, he says that he was just outraged that a renowned decisor would permit something so disgusting and abominable. Even the Catholics and the Pope, the Cardinals, whoever he was referring to, would think this is disgusting. How can we Jews possibly allow something that the Catholics find an abomination? Ramosha didn't care. I didn't quote Ramosha's truth. Ramosha said, deal with it. This is Judaism. This is not Catholicism. We have our own religion. We have our own Torah. We have our own principles for deriving the forbidden and the permitted. And I just don't care. If you make a halakhic argument, I'll listen to it. But the fact that the Catholics think it's a bad idea, that's their religion. They can do that. We simply do not care. How to deal with the Magen Avraham is the argument gets very technical and quite involved. But this is just an example of how. So again, Rav Breisch had many other reasons for being against it, and this was just one small point. But Rav Breisch explicitly said that he would forbid a practice due to the fact that Christians deem it morally repulsive. And Moshe says, I don't care at all. The Torah says we do not follow Darchei Hamori. It's actually prohibited to follow the religious customs of the non-Jews. So here you have two diametrically opposite attitudes. So again, the Shalom Eshev we saw, if anything, sounds a lot more like Rav Reish. He said that if the non-Jews have an intellectual property idea, we ought to too. Rav Moshe says, no, find me a source in the Torah, or I'm not going to care particularly. So the next couple of sources I brought are even perhaps more removed from practical Chashon Mishpat. You know, I learned at least in high school when we learned political theory. So we learn about how in the Enlightenment, the 18th century, the 17th century, John Locke, and then the Thomas Paine and the rest of them, you know, they had this radical new idea that government is legitimized by the consent of the governed. That you know, they used to believe in something called divine right of kings. They used to believe that the powerful could rule simply by virtue of his being powerful. And people apparently didn't really question the moral right of a king or a despot to rule. And with the winds of the Enlightenment, the people started to view things very differently. And we have, of course, our Declaration of Independence, which says that the king has no right to rule if he's a tyrant, and if the people don't want him, then he has to leave. So I was very amused once to find that this exact debate actually being conducted in the 15th century in Spain. Spain is not a country, certainly not then, that we would consider particularly progressive. And we kind of think of the Spanish Catholic monarchs as being despots. But the Abarbanel, who lived during the expulsion, who lived in the late 16th century, in the late 15th century, first in Portugal, then Spain, he has this incredibly dramatic account. It comes out of a spy thriller about how he received the mysterious message to run, and then he ran to the border, and the king's men were after him, and he just made it across the border before they caught up with him. Anyway, he spent a lot of time in the courts of Spain and Portugal. The Abarbanel, if you've ever read much of his work, is always at his best, at his most entertaining, when he's writing about politics. He moved in the courts of some of the great monarchs of the time. He more than just moved. He was a highly ranked financier, a counselor, a courtier, and he knew of what he spoke, as they say. So whenever he gets into politics, he's always fascinating, particularly fascinating. So he tells us. The first few paragraphs I quote are from his commentary to Shoftim, where the Torah tells us the laws of monarchs. So after discussing various questions about the halacha, the Torah's approach to monarchy, he says, one of the melech is a ra ublial, a scoundrel, a villain. So Tarach Lachka, we have to investigate, is it appropriate for the nation to overthrow him or not? So not only does he write this in his sefer, he says, Ani dibarti bedrusha zel ifnei malachim im chachameim. I have discussed this matter in front of kings. I don't know how they got away with this, suggesting to the king that he rules only by the consent of the people. I'm not sure, but he claims he did. And apparently he debated the matter with non-Jewish scholars. They took the more modern position that became more famous several centuries later, that the king only rules with the consent of the governed, and if he is a tyrant, they can throw him out. Rav Abarbanel defended what we would consider the reactionary position. I demonstrated, he says, she'eno meharoi, it's not right for them to rebel. They have no ability to rebel. And he makes numerous arguments. We're not going to read all the details of his arguments. He makes a number of arguments. The first one essentially is within the theory of the social contract, even accepting that the right of the king does come from some sort of contract with the people. That's very nice, he says, but the contract is unconditional. There's nothing in the contract that allows for withdrawing based on the bad behavior of one party. They're locked in for life, and no matter how badly one party behaves, the other party is still bound by the contract. The third one actually is close to what we would consider the divine right of kings. He applies it specifically to Jewish monarchs and says that since, properly speaking, Jewish monarchs are appointed one of the people who have to sign off our prophets, and they have God's, they tell us God's will, we have to listen. Now, whether this itself would be called a halachic dispute, I mean, obviously this is not so relevant today since we don't really have kings, but halacha, properly understood, really does encompass such things. There are hilchos malachim. The Rambam famously does have the laws of kings, and halacha really, broadly understood, is really quite large. If there would be a king, which again, we don't have today, this would, as I see it, really qualify as a halachic question. People come to the basement all the time on real estate contracts and ask, the seller has done this and this, does this give me the right to renege on my contract? And we have to answer either yes or no, depending on the text of the contract, depending on the law, depending on the custom. This would be a question if we had a king. The king might not let you get away with it. It would depend on who's stronger. People sometimes argue that the civil war the outcome of the Civil War finally decided the question of secession, whether states have the right to secede. Other people point out the Civil War did no such thing. The Civil War showed that the North's industrial base was stronger than the South's. It has no bearing at all on the legal question of the right to secession. So, but anyway, this would be a halakhic question. The question of revolution is a is discussed by the Abravanel, possibly other people, although I don't have any other sources on the topic. And then the next thing I cited is also an Abravanel, also not what we think of as a halakhic issue, but arguably something that deals with conduct that halakha would have an opinion on. This is really a fascinating piece. You know, we can talk about cultural influences on rabbis, on poskim. This is really a remarkable example, in my opinion. The Abravanel is writing on the story of Shimon and Levi, you know, the Shechem. Shechem, there was the unfortunate episode of Dinah. Shimon and Levi retaliated by wiping out the entire city. So Yaakov was not happy with this. Yaakov said, this is a really bad idea. Achartem osi b'yoshev haaretz, that this is, you've turned the entire local population against us, and we're mesei mispar, there are very few of us, and what are we going to do? Shimon and Levi retorted, hachazone yasis hachasenu. Shall they make our daughter, our sister, shall they treat her as a prostitute? So Shimon and Levi's answer seems to be something of a non sequitur. Yaakov said this is really dangerous. He didn't say they didn't deserve it. He said this is a really bad idea, real politic. We're not strong enough to fend off the entire Canaan. And they said, we can't tolerate this. So the Abravanel explains this just as it sounds. He says Yaakov was making a cold and calculating decision as to whether this was a good idea. And Shimon and Levi says, yeah, we might die for this, but that's the way it goes. Death with honor is better than a life of disgrace and shame. This is certainly the kind of thing that we think of when we think of, you know, Spanish honor and King Arthur and his round table and stuff like that. How honor is so important that this is certainly a very Iberian value. It's not the kind of thing we think of as a Torah value. Whether the Abravanel was influenced by the culture in which he moved, you know, there's no way to prove that, obviously. But here we do have what does seem to be a very, very medieval, very chivalric idea has been imported into a biblical narrative by Abravanel. Returning to Choshen Mishpat now, back to rent control legislation. So as I mentioned earlier, there are some poskim who justify rent control based on its being a custom, based on the fact that once the government sets up the laws, people generally follow the customs. And therefore, halacha recognizes the customs as creating an implicit contract. There are, however, many poskim who have discussed rent control in halacha. This may be one of the most widely discussed law halacha intersections of the 20th century. The discussions began mostly in the post World War I era, due to the dislocation and economic chaos brought about by the Great War. So poskim began to discuss the matter then. So there was a celebrated debate back then. Between two major poskim of the time, about 1920, one was Rav Meir Arik, the Rav of Tarna, who I did not quote here. The other one was a contemporary of his, Rav David Menachem Manis of Tarnopol. Rav Meir Arik was a great, I think they were Galicia, somewhere in Eastern Europe, was a great authority of the time. The Rav of Tarnopol, the author of the Chavos El Hasharon, was another great authority. They had a sharp dispute about whether halacha believed in rent control or not. There were a number of technical issues about the scope of Din Malchusa, which we will not discuss. But basically, Rav Meir Arik felt that halacha did recognize rent control, and the Rav of Tarnopol felt that it did not. So he has a long tshuva explaining why not. But one of his final paragraphs is very interesting. It just gives you a picture of how he approached the question of law. He says, even the Rav of Tarni says Rav Meir Arik only said so right after the war, when things were desperate. And basically, the arguments he makes are exactly the sorts of arguments you hear for modern free market, academic conservatives, academic libertarians, economic libertarians, that he says, you know, why is rent control such a great idea? It helps out. You know, the knee-jerk reaction is that it helps the renters. Okay, that's very nice, but you're depriving landlords of their property without due process, and you're privileging certain groups of tenants against others. In Manhattan, apparently, I hear this is a problem, that tenants get in there, they stay for 50 years, and nobody can find an apartment because all the rent control apartments are all kept. And I don't know anything about the debate. I mean, so I'm not going to take one side or another, but this is what I read, that, you know, that these kind of arguments are often how the conservatives and the libertarians retort to the liberal, to the more statist ones. They argue that that it's not fair on philosophical grounds, and it's you're just shifting the economic burden from one class of society to another. And the Rav of Tarnopol was so suspicious of rent control, he writes, the last paragraph I quoted in the Hebrew, he writes, "Beprat sheyadua lanu," that this law, he says, comes from some of the new members of parliament, the new appointees, he says, who have the opinions of the communists and the socialists to squeeze the rich, he says, and to take away their money. Just tones of horror you can hear from him. Kol eilu hashitas heim neged das Torah, he says. These socialistic and communistic views are simply against das Torah. And chalila to say this is din Torah. But this is not the last word on the subject. As I quoted a fascinating and little known, I'm sorry for using the word fascinating too often, that's a bad habit. I quoted from Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. Yigal, I think, told me that you have a Henkin who teaches at the school. I think that's a grandson of his, a music teacher. But Rav Henkin, grandfather, was the grand old man of American halacha. So he has a tshuva, a little known tshuva. I've rarely seen any discussion about it printed in his collected works. He was arguing with some other rabbi who he does not name, who apparently was also skeptical toward rent control. And Rav Henkin himself was very, very enthusiastic. We're not going to read everything he says here. He has some very important principles and rules about Din Malchusa, but roughly speaking, his point is that many of the earlier discussions, he says, about Din Malchusa, when it applies, when it does not apply, many of the earlier discussions, he says, was when the Jewish community had more autonomy. When we had the Kehillah structure, we had our own before the Enlightenment, before Napoleon, but before these types of modern innovations, the Jews in certain ways had more control over their own society. The government simply said, maybe you're second-class citizens, but you govern yourself. We will deal with the heads of the community. You set your own laws. You pass cherims. If you've ever, many svarim, you'll see, say, they'll have notes, cherim we're not allowed to do today. This was one of the great pushes of the Enlightenment governments to take away the power of excommunication from the Jews. This was an attempt to destroy the Jewish autonomy, to destroy the tools they had to police themselves. So Rav Henkin says that many of the more restrictive and skeptical approaches to Din Malchusa that you find in earlier poskim were written when the Jewish community had more power, more autonomy. Today, he says, and this is true, again, this is he's writing probably in the 50s or 60s, where the basin system was not as well developed as it is today, where there was very little Jewish, the American Jewish community was much weaker than it was today. He says, today, we need the law, we need the courts. We don't have our own system to provide our own law and our own courts. I don't know whether he would have said exactly this today, because today there are Batei Din. You know, different strata of society has them. We have the Basin of America, we have Haredi Batei Din, we have Hasidish Batei Din. So it's hard to know what he would have said today. This is one major point he makes, that certainly Din Malchusta has to be followed more than it used to because we don't have a parallel system of our own. Regarding rent control, he says, Chok Hadiroth Shel HaMemshala Hu Yashar, Mesuka and Mekubal, as opposed to the Rav of Tarnopol, who felt it was socialistic, communistic, Chalila, and bad economics and bad policy. He says, it's Yashar, it's Mesuka, and it's Mekubal. It's wonderful, he says. And regarding his correspondent's charge, that it's not a good idea because it privileges poorer tenants, and it tends to be against rich, luxurious farms. He says, good, that's what the law is supposed to do. The law is supposed to help out the downtrodden and the oppressed, and help out the disadvantaged in society. So again, I'm not claiming either of these Jewish are halacha, and everything we've mentioned today are just to try to give some picture of some of the sorts of arguments and the types of perspectives that you find in the poskim and the mefarshim, like the Ravenel. For any actual shilas, you know, the rules are complicated, and you should contact someone competent in these areas. But I've tried to give just some general background for how the halacha and the hashkafa of the Torah approaches these issues. We ran a little late. You can probably take a few questions if anyone has anything to say. Yes?
So frequently you'll take something like laws on a horse and buggy and apply that to cars.
So a car, halachically speaking, is generally considered what we call adam mazik, what we call human mazik. Since he's considered to be in control of the vehicle, we would generally consider that to be not much different than if he was carrying a box and tripped and fell on somebody. We would use the cars, we don't usually compare it to animals, we would usually compare them to direct human torts. But we do it to the get. We do take the laws of pits and apply them to potholes, for example, or to potholes, a state thing, a city thing usually. But yeah, we do attempt to the best as we can to apply the classic laws to the modern situation.
So, laws about a king, I would say that was almost always the only form of government. So why can't we say they would, that would also be applied to something now? The government we have now may not be a king, but they may have been, for all intents and purposes, their laws on kings and laws on government.
Many posts can do that. Many posts can, for example, have applied some of the laws of kings, let's say, to the Israeli government or to the American government. Many posts can have argued that the fact that it's democratic as opposed to a monarchical system makes no difference, because, as you said, the Gemara talks about kings because that was the only form of government, and that any legitimate or even not legitimate, the governments then didn't have all that much legitimacy necessarily. So many Pesukim have argued that the fact that we're representative and parliamentary and democratic makes no difference, and the laws of kings do apply to modern governments too. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Did you know this Rav Dovzal?
I don't know for sure. I believe he probably did come from the Hasidic areas of Europe, but I don't know enough about it. I didn't check his bio before. I'm sorry.
You said that there are buckets in each different Jewish community. So if you'll just have a case, are there differences between the outcomes of the bucket in the different communities?
There's no formal place where you'll find a list of differences, but if you have some familiarity with the systems, you learn after a while. So for example, I can tell you that the Basin of America, being modern Orthodox, being American, will tend to be much more favorable toward the law of the land than perhaps certain Batidin you're working with. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just a descriptive fact. They will take, let's say, the law of the land much more seriously than certain groups of Judaism, certain factions of Judaism who tend to have a more tense relationship with the host culture. Certain specific issues, Batidin get a reputation for ruling one way or another, even just on specific issues. Some Batidin will have, let's say, very protectionist attitudes. The law of competition, for example, Ani Hapik Bacharar, when can an incumbent competitor block a newcomer? The laws are complicated, but some Batei Din, for example, take a very protectionist stance. Some Batei Din take a much more free market stance. And then there are differences in procedure. Some Batei Din will take a much more Western approach to procedures, more openness, more recorded, more formal. Some Batei Din will take a much more Hamish, or much more informal, or... So venue selection is important. Someone going to a dentaro, would be wise to try to find out the style of the basin, as well as the procedures, as well as certainly the integrity and the competence. But yes, there are differences in the budget. Sorry.
Just to clarify, the reason there is any halachic issue with brand control is because the Gemara doesn't say anything that...
Essentially, right, that's a good point. I should have said that more carefully. The first of all, there's silence, that generally anytime the Gemara doesn't say something, as I said, halakha tends to be by default laissez-faire. Anything not specifically restricted by the Gemara gives citizens full freedom of contract. Also, there is actually some halakha that deals with similar rent control issues. The Gemara does talk about how much notice has to be given, and even if we don't apply the exact rules, 12 months in a big city and 3 years for a commercial establishment, even if we don't apply the rules, the exact rules found in the Talmud, but even if we just abstract away the principles are still much more laissez-faire. You have to give a fair amount of notice, but you don't have to give lifetime incumbency to the tenants.
Okay.